creating space for birds, and what do we know about UAPs? You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. After launching into space, one veteran Canadian astronaut is bringing her knowledge back to Earth to study another form of flight. Roberto Bonder is studying how birds travel around our planet. Her hope is to use migratory patterns to help scientists develop better aerial travel and respect Earth's bird species. We'll speak with Bonder about how she photographed these animals in her new book, Space for Birds: Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. Then we turn to the unidentified objects that fly in the sky. The conversations around UAPs, or unidentified aerial phenomena, have grown in the media and in government over the past few years, including recent congressional hearings. We'll speak with author and science journalist Sarah Scholes about the search for extraterrestrial life. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Birds and spacecraft have a lot in common. And Roberta Bonder, the first Canadian woman astronaut and neurologist in space, believes that birds could teach humans how to fly more efficiently while learning how to better care for our planet. The career path that led her into orbit on the Space Shuttle Discovery back in 1992 deepened her appreciation of nature on our planet. In her new book, Space for Birds: Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight, Bonder captured images from two different bird species, some shots taken while she was in the air herself. She joins us now to talk about the book, her flying experience, and the connection between birds in space. Roberta, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Roberta, in 1992, you flew on Space Shuttle Discovery on STS-42 into orbit, and now you wrote a book photographing birds. Please tell me, connect the dots. How did we get from space to down here on Earth tracking birds?
Well, in the book itself, I have a number of space photographs because what occurred to me in orbit was that I couldn't hear bird sounds. I know it sounds trite, but honestly, when you're up surrounded by a lot of human-made equipment and you can't see life and you certainly can't hear it. So it was for me, it was a bit of a harbinger of what it would be like if we lost things in the natural environment.
Did you have an interest or fascination with birds before you left the planet?
From the time I was a little girl, and I used to look at birds, and when we used to go camping in Wisconsin, Michigan from Sioux, Canada, my parents were very, very good about looking at the natural world and getting us interested in naming butterflies and birds. In biology, I excelled and decided that if there was a time when I could do something to help birds in any way, that I would like to do it. So I had a few career things that I was doing along the way, became a doctor, etc. And then when I got into space, I thought, I want to do something when I come back for the world that I couldn't see from space. And that was the natural environment upon which we depend so much.
I know there is the overview effect, right? This once you leave the planet and you see our planet against the blackness of space and you see that thin blue line, it kind of changes your perspective on things. And it sounds like you had that moment with the natural world and with the wildlife down here on Earth. Did you not?
I believe very deeply that we take our personal biases up into space. And so people who are very committed to a religious sense become more committed afterwards, or something else that they have valued before they left the planet. I went up there with a background steeped in science, but I also wanted to be very open to new ideas or to a new thought, so that I wanted to get above the planet. I wanted to look at the planet, but it was also important for me to look beyond the planet. And when I did, it was this light-sucking black, is all I can call it, and stars that don't twinkle, just pinpricks of light. It really focused my attention on the planet below me that was reflecting sunlight, basically, back up to my eyes. And it set a whole new tone for me to see the edge of our planet against this infinite black universe beyond. I think it was that kind of edge moment, that to see the Earth as a planet, to be in that moment.
Were you prepared for that moment?
I was prepared in the sense that it was like my arms were open like solar panels in terms of my frame and my head. I wanted to do more than just the science, because as the first Canadian woman in space and the world's first neurologist, I wanted to use my whole sensory system to try to bring this adventure back to people who are not going to fly in space, but to try to put some kind of realistic tone around it, to be able to communicate that. That was the important thing to me, whether it was through photography or through words. I just felt it was important to do that. And that's what I wanted to wrap my mind around, but I wasn't quite sure what the edges were going to look like when I got up there. I prepared the best I could, looking at all kinds of Earth observation photographs from other space missions before my flight, but it certainly wasn't the same sense as the reality of being there.
One thing I always find so fascinating about talking to astronauts is how they utilize a photography from orbit, from their spacecraft, and they get some training on it before they go up there, right? Had you been an amateur photographer before getting up to orbit, and how did your training prepare you to take images from space?
When I grew up in my hometown, it's not really an area where one would think you'd have a lot of contact with high-end cameras. But I was very fortunate that my dad was interested in photography. And although we couldn't afford cameras, my uncle, who was a bachelor at that time, he was the Northern Ontario rep for Leica and Nikon, and he was a pharmacist. So he'd have these cameras in his drugstore. And so he would loan these to my dad. So I learned about sharing and learned about the value of photography from a very early age. And then throughout my scientific training, through my master's and PhD program into my medical career and also as a neurologist, I was using photography to be able to talk about the specimens I was looking at.
And so that translated to what you brought to orbit when you were taking shots from orbit?
Yes, it did. And the other thing that I really became convinced of is that I needed other professional training. And we had the IMAX camera on board for getting scenes from Destiny in space. One of the things that I cherished was that I had interaction with the IMAX crew. And they said, well, Roberta, you know, if you want to do this, then perhaps you should go to Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara, California, as it was in those days, and take some more courses. So I did. So that after my space flight, I really became much more focused on looking at the planet in a way that I had wanted to, but with much more professional capability.
It's not lost upon me that you're taking your experiences in photography before your space flight up to space, but now you have taken your space flight experience and brought it to your photography. Some of these images that you have in this book, you're flying an aircraft. How has that kind of influenced the way you select photos or frame photos or decide what you're going to take images of?
As a fixed-wing pilot, I'm quite shocked that I am thrilled to be in a helicopter taking images. But the advantage of the aerial work is that it's a platform in between space and the surface. It's a platform that we can share with birds. It allows me to try to express what they might be seeing in terms of relationship between land and water. So the habitat itself, as much as the inhabitants, is extremely important to me. And so I wanted with the aerial work to make them artistic. So as a pilot, I could tell the helicopter pilot, I wanted to, you know, bank 3 degrees more, or I wanted to pitch in a certain way, or if I wanted to rotate or go back, I could do all this. And the pilots were very, very keen because we had conversations before flight about what I was trying to accomplish. Because as you said, my view of the planet was much changed by my experience in space, to see things from different angles, to not be disoriented because things were kind of upside down and sideways. And I learned the value of the horizon in my images. But this whole business of obliqueness, which is not necessarily a comfortable direction for people on the planet, they prefer horizontal and vertical, and became very important in my work and how I try to create these artistic panels.
So your background in aircraft and space flight, it definitely helps with the mechanics of taking photographs, but you also managed to capture the flight of birds, which is much different than the mechanical flight that we're used to. Tell me a bit about what you're trying to capture when it comes to the mechanics of flight in these birds.
Yes, the two birds that I feature in this book, long legs and long necks, and one of them's endangered and is white and it's in the Western Hemisphere, and the other is pink and in the Eastern Hemisphere. So I wanted to be able to show off these birds on the two hemispheres as an astronaut. So I was able to do that. And I picked large birds so I could see them from the air. So that was another quality that I wanted, to be able to try to show somehow their migration corridor. And I can't do that without a huge video that goes on forever. But I thought at least if I could take images, first of all, I wanted my pals in the astronaut program to photograph from the International Space Station various coordinates along the migratory corridors, because from space you can't see the whole migratory corridor in one view. It's just too big from low Earth orbit. That was one piece. And then The next piece, the aerial part, to show them they're actually in the environment. It was hard sometimes, certainly for the whooping crane. I did not want to get close to them. It's something I just don't want to do. So I was up 1,000 feet. I would not get lower than that. And then when I followed the whooping crane across the United States, for example, down from Canada, I wanted to fly over the areas of their very narrow but well-known flight migratory corridor, 4,200 kilometers each way. Twice a year they do this. So I wanted to be able to show that they are very strong, that they had the idea that they had a home to go to, that they relied on the actual world of Earth to be able to maintain this long migration that they make. And with the lesser flamingos, it was more of an opportunity to actually be above them when they were flying, because they have groupthink so different than the whooping crane, and they all fly off together. So you can see that from the air, but certainly the whooping cranes are much more solitary. The differences in the flight, that's what I wanted to show as well, that the strength and the power and the emotional connection that these birds have to this corridor and the faithfulness to it was very important to me.
Your focus on these birds goes beyond just the book, right? Can you tell me a bit about your work with the Avian Migration Aerial Surface Space Project?
Yes, when I started as an astronaut, you know, you always want acronyms. When I was becoming a principal investigator with NASA on bird migration a number of years ago, to be able to continue to access space files, I decided on this term called AMAS. It stands for Avian Migration Aerial Surface and Space, the three perspectives that I use in the book. We've also called it Space for Birds because astronaut fights, like non-space travelers might have a problem with this acronym, but NASA loved it. We refer to that as the AMAS project. In fact, NASA did a nice video about the project put on their Earth Observation website, and they really enjoyed AMAS. So that's where that came from. So we are continuing to look at endangered and near threatened species in the world. And I'm currently now into, I call it book two only because I don't have a working title for it yet, but it will feature a few other birds, much smaller and none that I can really photograph from the air. They're too small, but I can certainly photograph their habitat and create artistic images of that. But they are the, you know, things like the piping birds, like the piping plover or the red knot or Sprague's pipit, the Arctic tern. These are birds that are in North America or in the Western Hemisphere. They go down to the southern hemisphere sometimes for overwintering. So we're following them, and they're delightful birds, and just trying to raise people's awareness of other kinds of birds is very important to me.
Roberta, I want to end our conversation by going back to the beginning. You know, a theme of this book is the fragility within ourselves and within the birds. In fact, you write, we see our fragility in theirs, and we are moved to learn more to help us to help them. What is the takeaway that you want readers to gain from this book that really does combine the beauty of nature and the scientific importance of protecting our planet?
If we ignore the natural world, we do it at our own peril. We need the natural world to do so many things. I mean, there's a view of looking at it as a service industry. I'd like to look at it a bit more emotionally, because there are living organisms that are fragile. You set aside plants and trees, which you just don't want to get rid of either. But when we look at things like birds, they actually can pull us across the planet. And when we study them, we actually see areas and are become much more sensitive to areas that require research, or that we can learn things and adapt them to our technology. We can learn about the dynamics of flight still. We can learn about the efficiencies. I mean, we don't understand this groupthink that lesser flamingos have, for example, or that people see when they see all these blackbirds flying in unison, and then suddenly in one split second they move as one. So all the technology that is out there for us as humans to learn from and to incorporate into our own world to try to make it a better place, a more inspirational place, a place that does have hope, and a place from which we can have terrestrial applications of being aware of the natural world. It was indelible for me from my space flight.
Roberta, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Roberta Bonder, the first Canadian woman astronaut and neurologist in space, and author of Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. Still to come, What's that in the sky? Could it be a UAP?
One of the largest organizations in the United States is called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, where if you see something like in your backyard, you can go to their website, submit a report, and fill out all kinds of information about the details, and then they'll set an investigator on it to try to figure out what it was that you saw and whether it's extraordinary or not.
The public reaction to the conversations about UAPs, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. UAPs, or Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon, have been documented throughout human history, and now recent conversations have gone mainstream, including NASA signaling its interest in collecting data on UAPs and Congress holding public hearings on the matter. The most recent hearing happened last month, and now the public is once again talking about what knowledge the government may have had about unidentified aerial objects.
Science requires data, which should be collected without bias or prejudice. Yet, whenever the topic of UAP arises, those who wish to explore the phenomena are often confronted with resistance and ridicule.
Here to talk about the new conversations around UAPs is Sarah Scholes, science journalist and author of the book, They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So Sarah, UAPs are back in the news again with some more recent congressional hearings. Before we talk about broadly what this means, let's take a step back. What does the term UAP mean and why has it entered kind of the mainstream news cycle as of the past few years?
UAP is a fancy new term for UFOs. It means unidentified aerial phenomena. And my understanding of why we switched from the very well-known acronym to this lesser-known one is that the term UFOs has a stigma attached to it. You know, you think flying saucers, you think weird people looking up at the sky seeing weird things. And I think in this latest round of UFO fervor, there's been kind of a national security focus, like people in the military, and as you mentioned, in Congress are concerned about what's going on in the skies. And so they wanted to have kind of this serious valence and disassociate it from what had come before. And so here we are with UAP.
And the kind of chatter about this stemmed from some mainstream coverage of the phenomenon, right? The New York Times, I'm thinking of the Tic Tac video. Was that kind of the turning point for UAPs to get put into the spotlight of the general public?
Yeah, UAPs kind of always go through this cycle of being very popular and then sort of disappearing from mainstream public consciousness. And so this latest rise to prominence started around 2017 when the New York Times published an article about a Defense Department program that allegedly studied UFOs. And so that kind of kicked off mainstream interest and then also defense interest in the topic. You know, if there are things flying around in the skies, particularly near military bases, and we can't identify them, you know, whether they're aliens or drones or whatever, that's a legitimate concern. And for the record, I don't think they're aliens. But from there, it kind of took off. The people who were involved in that initial program went public with their concerns, and it just kind of has been spiraling for, I guess, now the last 7 or so years, which is a pretty long flap, as they call UFO rises and falls.
You know, in your book, They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers, you look at the people that are involved in this community who are trying to figure out what this is, who track these things and may or may not believe that they are the aliens. But I want to ask about what you've learned from writing this book. Who is interested in these things outside of the mainstream media? What kind of person is tracking UFOs and saucers and having a keen interest in this particular topic?
Yeah, I think there's a few groups of people. And the one that has always interested me are people who just get really deep into the history and the documents and say for 70 or 80 years, humans have been interested in UFOs and why is it such a persistent phenomenon? And so they're kind of agnostic about what UFOs are or are not, and are just kind of really attracted to the mystery, the idea that this phenomenon in whatever interpretation you have has been around for a long time. And so they want to figure out that kind of human dimension. But I think probably the largest fraction of people are those who have maybe had some kind of personal experience seeing something that they themselves couldn't understand. And that kind of sets off a chain of research for them where they try to find out what other people have seen and get kind of deep into the lore and the mythos. And I think those are people who tend to more fall on the alien side of things.
And what current resources are out there for someone who may have had that experience? I mean, to me, it sounds like this is scientific inquiry at the foundation. You see something you can't explain, you experience something you don't understand, and you go looking for answers. Where can people find answers?
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think that that's something that attracted me to the topic. Like, I think people who are interested in UFOs are fundamentally a lot like journalists or scientists who see a problem and a question and want to find an answer. One of the largest organizations in the United States is called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, where if you see something like in your backyard, you can go to their website, submit a report, and fill out all kinds of information about the details. And then they'll set an investigator on it to try to figure out what it was that you saw and whether it's extraordinary or not. And then another resource I would point people to is a website called The Black Vault, which sounds very ominous, but is a website where a researcher named John Greenwald has kind of collected tons and tons of mostly governmental documents about UFO research. And so people can kind of put whatever they see in context.
I know that those organizations have existed for quite some time, especially MUFON. It's been around for decades. But as you start seeing more and more of the conversation of UAPs in places like congressional hearings, last time we had you on the show, we talked about NASA's panel to investigate these UAP sightings. Is this topic gaining more and more legitimacy because of all of these rather serious organizations and groups taking the issue seriously?
I think it is. And I think that has a lot to do with the scientific way that the organizations go about investigating them. Like, NASA's job, as we talked about, was to go find data in their archives that might be useful to uncovering how many unidentified things do people actually see in the sky, or do telescopes see in the sky, and then what can we learn from the data that we have? So kind of getting a baseline and then maybe some interpretation. And something similar has been going on with the Department of Defense, which now has an organization dedicated to finding, researching, and trying to identify sightings that members of the military might have. And so I think, you know, historically, a lot of UFO study has been a little more anecdotal, a little more personal. And anytime you have governmental organizations and also hard data, I think that makes things more serious and also is maybe more likely to result in those answers that everybody is looking for.
And is there an indication that these organizations have an answer? What does, say, someone from NASA think this is, or someone from the DOD think that these phenomena may be? Mind you, I know that there are many, many of these sightings, so there's not a catch-all explanation, but are there kind of some storylines or threads that these organizations are thinking this possibly could be?
Yeah, so NASA, I don't believe, hasn't published conclusions yet. They were mostly in the fact-finding phase. The Department of Defense has kind of categorized what they have seen into a few buckets. They're largely, when they have investigated things, they found mundane explanations, like either sightings that did not actually show something, you know, going super fast or disappearing right after you saw it, but more just like an unidentified piece of trash in the sky or a drone. Or historically, it's also been, you know, the U.S.'s own secret aircraft. But then always in any investigation, there are things that remain unidentified. And for the Department of Defense's, at least their first report, that was the preponderance of stuff was stuff they couldn't identify. And it falls into what a researcher named Mick West calls the low information zone, which means, you know, it's not necessarily that it's something truly wild. It's just that, you know, it happened a long time ago. We don't have enough data and we can't identify it based on what we have now. So lots of explanations, but all of them sort of up in the air, as it were.
Very good pun. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I try.
It was not lost on me. Do you think, Sarah, and this may be speculation at this point to even answer this question, but do you think that the push to have these hearings for UAPs at the congressional level, is that from, do you think, public interest and the public push for more information on this? Or do you think that there is legitimate data or information that these lawmakers are getting that is prompting these public hearings? If you can even answer that, what's the motivation behind public congressional hearings about UAPs?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a definitive answer, but I think if we were to take lessons from the past and put them in the present, the government often does respond to public interest and public concern. Like when everybody hears, hey, there's stuff flying around your military bases or your Navy ships and we don't know what it is, that's a legitimate source of public concern, a legitimate source of military concern. And so it can be a response to that. I do kind of think that general public interest has sort of fallen off a little bit from the peak right after the New York Times article. And so I do think it's coming from within the government now and then from people who have been involved in various government programs who are pushing for more research. I mean, I do think there is evidence in the data that we have from the Pentagon showing that there are things flying in the sky. They don't know what they are, and it's their job to figure it out. So I think, you know, a little bit PR, a little bit legitimate concern. And in my mind, more data is always good. And, you know, in terms of defense spending, it's not a huge amount of money. So we might as well, you know, try to figure some stuff out.
For someone who is just coming into this topic and hearing about how various organizations are looking into unidentified aerial phenomenon, you hear UAP, you hear the word UFO, you're seeing these congressional hearings, you know, NASA is looking into this. As someone who is just stepping into this topic, how should we approach it? Should we be hopeful for answers, skeptical of what we'll find, fearful of what's to come? How should we be approaching this?
If I were just coming into it, I would approach it mostly with personal curiosity. I wouldn't go straight to fear, for sure, but I would focus on doing my own research. I think, like, looking at those congressional hearings, looking at the reports from the Defense Department, looking at what NASA's doing, and kind of drawing your own conclusions from it, because no one has all the answers and everyone's coming into it with their own personal, you know, interpretations and experiences. And so I think I would encourage people to just, you know, gather as much information as they can and then evaluate it with their own perspective. And I guess then decide whether to be fearful or hopeful.
And you may not know the answer to this, so feel free to pass on this, but what's kind of the consensus in the UAP and UFO community when it comes to new presidential administration with a second Trump term set to take effect next year? Is there some optimism that more answers may come from Trump administration?
Yeah, I don't know that I know the incoming administration stance specifically on things, but I at least haven't heard anything about, you know, wanting to cancel the research and reporting program. So I think we can imagine that those will continue. And I do think, you know, at different times in history, it's been an issue for pass between the political parties, but I think it's a relatively bipartisan concern, especially from the defense perspective. I don't know that anyone can promise answers, but I think it's fair to expect that the research will continue.
So you're saying flying saucers will unite this country? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So much division, and here come the flying saucers.
Sarah Scholes is a science journalist and author of the book, They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. We're also on Blue Sky. Search for Are We There Yet? And if you have an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. Shoot us an email. We're arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Speaking of cfpublic.org, that's where you'll find more space coverage. Go ahead and visit our website. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Our intern this semester has been Jenna Weiss. Jenna, thanks for all you've done. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.